Hello, and welcome to the Emerging Tech Horizons podcast. I'm Mark Lewis, the Executive Director of the Emerging Technologies Institute at the National Defense Industrial Association. And today's podcast is going to focus on the President's budget for FY24 with a specific focus on S&T. And to help us explore that is my very good friend, Dr. Reed Skaggs, who is the Chief of Strategy and Business Operations Officer for Lewis Burke Associates. I'll tell you a little bit about Dr. Skaggs' background. Reed has a PhD in physical chemistry, got decades of experience within the federal defense establishment, and working with Lewis Burke clients for the last 8 years. Reed provides Lewis Burke clients with informed strategies and effective approaches to working with and collaborating with the national security enterprise. Reed has held various management leadership positions, such as serving as the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Army Research and Technology, and was the Acting Deputy Director for Ground Systems, Soldier Systems, and Training, and Biometrics. Reed led the formulation of the Army Research Laboratory's long-term S&T portfolio strategy, establishing new programs for materials, computational sciences, and neuroscience. His assignment to the White House Office of Science Technology Policy, where we first met, expanded his breadth of experiences to include developing national policies for high-skilled immigration, the United States accession to the Ottawa Convention, as well as addressing the health and sufficiency across the board for the national security S&T enterprise, approaching the 21st century and beyond. As the senior expert for Lewis Burke's defense practice, Reed develops and implements multifaceted initiatives that raise clients' federal profile, ranging from organizing briefings on Capitol Hill to providing advanced intelligence to position them for unique DoD funding opportunities. And as a scientist, Reed appreciates learning about emerging technical research areas, leverages personal curiosity for new federal efforts such as quantum information sciences, economic development, national security workforce development. And some recent examples of that include identifying emerging federal opportunities such as robotics, autonomy, quantum information science, and infectious diseases. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Reed Skaggs to the podcast today.
Reed. Thank you for having me, Mark.
Great to have you here. So I want to dive in. You've had a fascinating background, obviously working with the U.S. Army, leadership position in Army science, then going to the White House at OSTP, where you did phenomenal things in the National Security and International Affairs Office. And now your position at Lewis Burke, working with customers, with clients, informing them about the federal government, having them learn about new opportunities. How did you come to your current role? Could you just walk us through your background and your career steps?
Sure. After getting my PhD in combustion sciences from George Washington University, I went to work at the Army Research Laboratory as a postdoctoral scientist, and I was fortunate enough to be hired into federal service, but I went from very basic research in that postdoc to a very applied position where my combustion sciences were then used to replace the fire extinguishers in Bradley fighting vehicles. Okay. So the actual firefighting systems. And then over time, I got involved in a number of activities around armor, specifically around underbody explosives, landmines, and what we came to know as IEDs during the Iraq time period. I was fortunate enough when I used to hear your name in the Pentagon, but I never got to meet you. I worked for Dr. Tom Killian in the Army S&T office, where I spent what was supposed to be about a year, but about 2.5 years working with him on the Army's armor strategy for vehicles because of the conflicts we were having in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so that really opened my mind and stuff to what was going on in the big picture.
So I love the fact, I didn't realize this, you started out by putting out fires, literally, and you now put out fires figuratively. So that all kind of comes together.
Yeah, so when we met each other at OSTP, I really had this fascination because we were thinking about the health and sufficiency of the national security S&T enterprise, that everybody always talks about this triangle of industry, where we are here today, academia, and the laboratory. So I've been in the lab, and I'd done some work with universities in the past. I funded one of your colleagues back in the day to do a very small model of what a little explosive in sand would look like that we then extrapolated to a full-scale situation against vehicles. And I was like, you know, these guys are pretty good, and it wasn't very expensive. And I was like, that was a pretty good relationship. So we, your organization and OSTP, really dove into this academic government relationship. And so when I had the opportunity to go to Lewis Burke, I said, oh, I can now see what it looks like on the other side of the equation. As you know, we represent a number of universities throughout the country, scientific societies, as well as associations that are advocating for research and STEM development.
What I find particularly fascinating is now applying all those skills when you represent universities. You have to understand the equities of a university, what motivates faculty members, how to get them connected with the right people of the government. It's having also played similar roles. It can be a very, very challenging space in which to work.
Right. And you're the one who first educated me about how academia really works.
Yeah. Did I really? I'm not sure I know myself.
I've always benefited from that conversation, I feel like our role at Lewis Burke is really to help those, you know, we have very sophisticated clients all the time, but some are just not really understanding of this thing called the DoD Research Enterprise. Everybody knows the NSF pretty well. Everybody knows the NIH pretty well. But then it's like, I actually do this thing. How does DoD care about that? And so we try to help educate them to how program managers think about money, but also how Congress is thinking about programs. And so they can navigate through that to build out, you know, good proposals.
I'm biased, but I always prefer the DoD S&T Enterprise because it was always application focused. That was a big motivator for me. And I think that's true for a lot of faculty members.
It is. And I think a lot of universities, I think what's changed is we've gone from very fundamental research where we want to understand the limits of technology or the limits of science. Mm-hmm. And people really want to apply those. And I think that's a hard part when you look at the budget today of how do you connect the right people into the system so they can be a part of the development of an actual product.
Right.
And I think lots of people yearn to be there, but it's a very hard barrier to get across.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's talk about barriers. That'll be my segue. So as many of our listeners know, we are well on our way through the annual budgeting and appropriation process right now. And I want to start off by getting your thoughts on that process. What, first of all, do you think we learned from DoD's FY 2024 request, especially in the S&T realm?
Let me do a little bit of numbers here. Fact check me where I go wrong. So RDT&E is at $145 billion, highest it's ever been, right? The budget's the overall big budget there, where S&T is at $17.8 billion. So that's 12% of RDT&E. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty healthy budget in our opinion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at the pluses and minuses. You know, the Army went up. The Navy actually went down a little bit in 6-1 through 6-3. But they were putting that money into the 6-4. So a lot of what we see trend-wise for the last couple of years, back to the Trump administration, was lots of pushes of money into the 6-4 category, which for our clients, they start to be like, well, how do I get into the 6-4 category, which is not normally where a lot of even service laboratories get to be,
right.
Much less a university's back at 6-1, 6-2.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, as you point out, I will tell people, look, at the end of the day, DoD is the big dog on the block when it comes to funding science. You know, I'll compare, you know, the $17 billion NSF budget is,
just about 10.
Just about 10. NASA's in the $25 billion range, but only a small fraction out of science. I think NIH is probably the second largest at about 35, close to $40 billion.
Yep.
So DoD really does swamp that.
It does. But then it's very broken apart.
Right.
You know, you've got to take care of the basic research community. You've got the laboratory community that you got to think through. And then kind of where you get past there is who are the early adopters? Who, you know, where are the companies, especially in this day and age where I think you've seen over the last 30 years, technology is really being pushed by the market forces, especially in information technologies, et cetera, where the government just can't lead anymore because it doesn't have the market that these other guys can go after.
Right. You know, I would cite the example of microelectronics, for example, that the DoD is just a small fraction, less than about 2% of the microelectronics market. So it's very hard for DoD to drive that market. The clever strategy is to get on the commercial curve as much as possible. And I think we're seeing that in more and more areas.
Yeah, and I think you guys started back in when you were in the administration, and now you're seeing, I think it's finally been thought through of like, okay, we got these very unique applications that aren't going to necessarily have commercial entities, but we need chips to do certain things for certain applications that if we're going to be on the battlefield, you know, especially I worry more about the Taiwan situations than I worry about a Ukraine situation, because I think that's a completely different dynamic for technologies that we have never really had to think through.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. So continue with our dive in the 2024 request. In your opinion, what do you think they got right? What did they do well? And then I'm going to ask you, what did they get wrong? What's lacking?
Well, depending on if you depending on how you think about the administration's priorities. And I think in this administration, we're seeing a lot of consistency in all budget requests from all federal agencies that they meet kind of Biden's top four things. You know, you see a lot of equity things. You see a lot of workforce initiatives. You see a lot of economics. I mean, this is the first, if you look at, back to microelectronics, you look at the CHIPS bill from last summer, we were making serious, serious investments as a government in science and technology, and it doesn't hit DOD that as big as it does in these other agencies.
Yeah.
So I think DOD did okay in that respect. And DARPA, I think, in your meeting a couple weeks ago with Ms. Hsu and Dr. Tompkins, you know, they said deliberately, we are trying to take on the next generation of microelectronics, and they laid out that spectrum of where we are today, where they think they should be, and how all this chips and science is going to kind of fill in the middle to include what I think Dr. Shinoli is trying to do for the department.
Yeah, and I guess I'd argue that that kind of makes sense. That's their role. DARPA needs to be pushing the longer horizons,
which is independent of chips and science.
Right.
That's their own money that they're taking part. I mean, I guess now DARPA has crossed the $4 billion mark.
Right.
And it's interesting to watch on the other side of the world where we're going to invent an ARPA-H and former DARPA people over there setting that up. You know, they're sitting on probably about $1 to $2 billion, and they got four program managers, and they got to be in three different locations in the country. I mean, there's lots of dynamics already to, I can't imagine DARPA in 1963 was like, oh, you know, how's this all going to work? It's like, it's like hard problem, go solve it.
Yeah. A good reference, by the way. One of my favorite authors, Sharon Weinberger, has this definitive history of DARPA, and it's a fascinating book because she walks through that and how much DARPA has changed over the years. I'm especially struck by the number of times people have tried to reproduce the DARPA formula, and it so seldom works or works as well as the original DARPA. I mean, we've seen countries overseas attempts at recreating DARPA, and they tended not to work. But when it does work, it works really well. I think IARPA got the formula down really well and have run with it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think where we struggle, I think, with all this is, you know, the budget, how does it accelerate technologies to the warfighter? I'll go back to the Taiwan, and there's starting to be, in probably some of the circles you're in, there's this discussion of what's called Offset X that's emerging. So we had, in the Obama administration, we had the third offset, which was preceded by the second offset that you lived through, and there was the first offset.
Yeah,
but this Offset X really, I think, is trying to think about how do you get disruptive in a place like Taiwan, which is already, or China, which has figured out how to push us farther away. So you got an energetics problem, you've got a sea problem, you've got an air problem. So you have these multi-domain problems where we haven't fought in that domain. Not in my lifetime.
Right. And first time in a long time we'd be dealing with such issues as contested logistics, for example. We haven't had to deal with that in any recent conflicts, right?
So the question I have is, Ms. Hsu is thinking about like experimentation and trying to get things into the warfighters. How does the community, and I live this in the Iraq situation, I mean, how do we get all hands on deck so we're not caught behind the eight ball if something was to go wrong in a couple of years? Because I remember those last couple of months of the summer of 2003 and into the fall, and all these IEDs were going off over and over and over. And everybody at our lab just stopped what they're doing and figured out how to get doors on the Humvees.
No, absolutely. That absolutely makes sense. You mentioned workforce issues. So how well do you think this request addresses our workforce challenges?
So I think this is the great challenge, right?
Yeah.
I think after COVID, you know, the data says that we're probably 9 to 10 million workers short in the country. Okay, that's just the entire workforce. Now I want to go think about doing quantum and AI and all these emerging technologies. And the question is, like, do we have the right pipelines? Like, somebody will say, oh, I've got a smart program. You know, that's 150. I mean, like, I think it's a... And I think this gets talked about more and more, especially like in your field, hypersonics. Like when we go to mass production, it's not going to be a bunch of PhDs running out of manufacturing machines. It's going to be an entire group of people who are like been in the community college, they've been in a union, they've been, and there's a
PhD. Right, yeah.
I just don't see where we have the experiences to put all those people in place right now to make this happen. They're like, oh, I see myself in that job.
Yeah, I think the hypersonics example is a great one. A few years ago, we did a study of hypersonic test facilities, And we originally started thinking PhDs and masters, graduates, and we realized that the biggest piece of the workforce we needed to worry about, exactly as you said, it was the technical workforce. It was the guys who knew how to turn the wind tunnel on and turn it off, who knew how to put the gauges on the models, who had to, you know, the temperature gauges and the pressure gauges. That was where we saw the loss of expertise, the loss of skill set. And, you know, if I can, you know, to emphasize your point, what I worry about isn't just a STEM pipeline, but then, which is important enough, it's a STEM pipeline into DOD or into supporting DOD. We can imagine, you know, students who are excited about artificial intelligence, they want to study that, but how do we get them the best and the brightest working on behalf of national defense in those areas? And there are so many challenges.
Yeah, and I think you need all levels. So I came from the lab, and I was fortunate enough to work with folks who, you know, we did explosive tests. So yours truly, PhD, did not go out and lay a TNT mine out every day. There was a group of men and women every day who came to work who were trained how to do that. And they did it very well. They knew how to collect data. They knew how to help make the experiment at those scales work, and that we could then get information that informed us on how to build protection strategies or, you know, what was the next. I mean, for a while, the first time we ever saw an EFP that was brought from overseas to us to exploit. And it was those folks who helped set up the experiment. We learned, hey, this is the threat. You know, so I'm more of an advocate, and this is probably not good by me, but I'm more of an advocate, and I think it was said about a week ago, like in microelectronics, we're 100,000 workers short if we're going to have all these semiconductor plants from the country.
Yeah.
Like, I just feel like it's an all-hands-on-deck problem.
Yeah, agreed.
And there's plenty, I think there's plenty of people in the university community that can get the PhDs and the masters that we need. I think that pipeline is easy. I think it's the under pipeline.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I agree with you absolutely. Okay, so we talked about what the new request is doing well. Can we do a comparison between 2024 and 2023?
Sure.
Major shifts? Or
sure.
What have you noticed?
One thing that's interesting to me is in the Army, which is in charge mostly of medical research, it looks like a lot of stuff got zeroed out. So in the old days when I worked at in the Pentagon, that was we were always told, don't be careful what you ask for.
Yeah.
If you're going to zero something out, be ready with the consequence. Like, okay, we're going to zero it out.
Yeah.
So that we thought that was that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Let's see. So this whole Space Force, and you're a space person.
Yeah.
Right. So
when I'm not a hypersonics person, I'm a space person. Yeah.
You know, the Senate last year in the last appropriations bill said, hey, we think the Space Force needs its own dedicated basic research. And they gave them $55 million to start up on both a DURUP program, which is a Defense University Research Instrumentation Program, which is, to me, one of the best programs the department does because it helps build capacity for folks to learn how to do
this. So the way it works is, if for example, if you're a university professor who's got or has an existing grant from a DoD funding agency, they can apply for additional money for equipment under the DURUP program that supports the grant, and everyone wins.
Or you can go get the piece of equipment as your first grant.
Right.
And then you become more competitive.
So, competitive with the grant, yes. So it works both ways, yes.
I've helped some non-client folks, especially in the HBCU, minority serving institution realms, like that's the money you should really be going after to help get your research enterprise. So you're competitive now of doing the research. So now you can go after, you know, other programs like the multi-university research.
The MIRI
program.
Right.
So Congress gave that to the Space Force, and the Space Force said, well, we'll go to zero now. But I would expect that because that was a congressional initiative. And so, you know, if I'm the Air Force, I'm like, why should I keep planning for that? But they did put a lot of money in space technology and prototyping. The Navy looks like they're putting a lot of money into some classified programs, which we don't know what they mean, but we just know they're labeled as classified programs. And a lot of more rapid prototyping. So I'm curious to ask the question back to the questionnaire. In your time, what were good prototyping programs, or what were, like, who's running that?
So actually, you know, so I'm going to answer your question a little bit differently. And of course, you know, there's been a lot of emphasis on prototyping programs to bridge that valley of death. So when I was in R&E, we had Jim Faist, who was the DDR&E for Advanced Capabilities. And a lot of his activity was focused on a lot of his portfolio were the prototyping programs to bridging that valley. A lot of classified programs that were extremely high value. Also, programs working with international partners to do prototypes with them, so that we had the multinational support. We were able to leverage capabilities of our allies. Of course, recently R&E has set up the radar program, and I think we're going to see how that program evolves. I think they have high hopes for that as a rapid prototyping program. I got high hopes for it.
I do too. For our community, we're at least for some of our clients, it gets a little challenging because there's this, I think there's a tension between trying to keep things, we live in a world where things get stolen and things are leaking, but then how do people know, like, I've got a great idea. How do I get in to help you with?
Yeah, exactly. What door do I walk into? Who do I? Yeah. Now I will say, when people talk about the Valley of Death, that famous virtual valley between the laboratory and delivering something to the warfighter, I sometimes call it the mountain of death. Because, in fact, there's a lot of, if you look at the funding, there's a lot of $6-4 and beyond. There's a fair amount of prototyping money. It's a question of how you leverage that money most effectively. How do you identify the things that the warfighter really wants? I'd even argue that some things should fail crossing that barrier.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, we're not being aggressive enough. We're not being creative enough.
Well, I look at the SpaceX launch last week, and it was it's a failure because it blew up. Actually, no, there's a lot of information. Elon's got tons of money. He can do experiments 1 through 10 but he will fight his way through to getting a successful thing.
Right.
Because he's learning from his failures. Not everything works on the first star.
Yeah, exactly. So we need to be willing to embrace failure. Now I'll get up on a soapbox and say there are noble failures, and then they're the dumb failures. Right? When you lose the test article because the cable was loose or the fin falls off or one of those. But when you learn something that you didn't know and can move forward, it's a very noble failure. We need to embrace it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was fortunate enough, probably my last 2 years of active research at the research lab, I was involved in what was called a Jaido project.
Yep.
We were doing underbody protection for all the vehicles in theater, not including Humvees. And we learned about the Valley of Death and the transitions. And in my mind, the most effective way we got through that barrier was when the actual program manager or the PEO came down and met with us and said, this is what I want, brought their contractors into the game and said, okay, you all work together. I need a solution in 30 days.
Yeah.
I don't know how this big enterprise now that we're talking about in AI, I'll use AI. How do people do an AI research? What PM are they talking to? Or in quantum, what PM are they talking to help, get a system out there?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of good stories. I've also seen a lot of bad stories along those lines, where we try to deploy technology without going through that step. So you're delivering something to a customer who can't use it or doesn't want it. And then it may be in some cases that if you just tweaked it a little bit, it would have been exactly what that customer wanted or could have used.
Right.
But because you haven't done that and you say, hey, I have this lovely widget for you, you can actually poison the well on that entire area of technology. Mm. And I've seen that in multiple instances. Flip side is I've seen some really good examples where the customer shows up and says, this is what I want, this is what I need. And sometimes what they think they need isn't what they actually need. Mm-hmm. My favorite example of that, there's a story, it might even be an apocryphal story. If it's not true, it should be true, that the Navy was pushing DARPA to develop faster underwater propulsion units, for when the Navy SEALs go on missions, they've got these handheld propulsion units, and the Navy wanted faster ones. And the DARPA folks were having trouble delivering that. And I finally asked, well, why exactly do you need this? They said, well, our SEALs are often operating in really cold water, and they can't spend a lot of time there. They need to get through that faster. And the DARPA response was, well, what if we just built you a better wetsuit? And that's actually what they only wound up doing, as the apocryphal story goes. But yeah, so you give them what they, not necessarily what they want, but what they need. But that involves a dialogue. That involves asking the question, why do you need this? How are you going to use it? And then the flip side, sometimes you do need the operator to say, hey, that's a wonderful idea you've pitched, but here's why it won't work, or here's why it's not compatible with my systems. And that dialogue, I think, is key. And it doesn't happen often enough.
I wish we could create more forums. I get that, the government, you can, if you talk to one, you got to talk to all.
Right.
So how do you create more forums? And I'll applaud the Basic Research Office. I think in the last couple of years, they've done a great job of getting out in the country and talking to people. They don't have to come here to Arlington. I mean, we went through COVID, nobody left their house.
Yeah.
But they get out now and they talk to people in different parts of the country. And I think, you know, to kind of go back to the beginning of this, you know, the Biden administration believes, in my opinion, they believe that, you know, if we are going to compete with China, we have to have a robust economic engines that can do that, and that everybody's involved. It's not just us on the coast. It's, you know, the people in the middle of the country who also are doing great stuff, and how they can, what I, layman's terms, how do you create multiple Huntsville Alabamas across our country?
Yeah.
Which is a very successful model.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
That's
right.
It went from a
very agricultural society to, yeah, it's a, well, I guess they call it Rocket City now or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, that's the example I think you want to see.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree completely. So if I can ask, any comments on the impacts on tech transition plans?
Well, that's what I think is what we were talking about earlier,
yeah,
which is, you know, kind of what is the plan for the community?
Yeah.
You know, I get there's an inside the building thing.
Yeah.
Okay. That's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, but how do you engage more of the community? I don't know how to do that. I wish I'd be happy to have a thoughtful, you know, discussion about, like, how do you bring more players to the table?
Right.
You know, do you assure that they don't have to have clearances, but
yeah,
they have, you know, they could be at the table and not jeopardize anybody's security.
When I was in the building, we had this team of principal directors that were developing roadmaps.
Right.
And then we had the debate about, well, do we release the roadmaps or not? And I'd say, well, you know, to the maximum extent, you need to release the roadmap, or else people don't know how they fit with the roadmap and how do they respond to your demand signal. You know, it's the old joke at the end of Dr. Strangelove, with what good is a doomsday bomb if you don't tell anyone you have it? Or what good is a roadmap if you don't tell anyone you have it? But then you run into these challenges of clearances and being fair to everyone and who do you share it with. So lots of hurdles to get through. Let's talk about manufacturing.
So I say that because
yeah.
Secretary Raimondo last week at an event, I think she made a very interesting statement.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be able to connect basic research
mm-hmm.
to manufacturing
mm-hmm.
in some way.
Mm-hmm.
She goes, it doesn't do us any good to invent something and not know how to make it. And I think that from a commerce standpoint, that's how she views, you know, the CHIPS bill, how she looks at these tech hubs,
right.
You know, and the Defense Department, you know, you could argue if it was good or bad policy, stood up these manufacturing institutes
yeah.
all across the country in these cutting edge manufacturing ways. And the question we have now is, we've got these technologies that are emerging. How do we get those technologies from the R&E side of the house to the acquisition side of the house?
Right, right. You know, I it's an excellent point. I'll argue, for example, one of the hurdles we have in developing new weapon systems are just the manufacturing costs. Hypersonics is the poster child for that.
Right.
We all know that to be fully deployed, for us to deliver hypersonics at scale, we need to get the manufacturing costs down, because that contributes a significant amount to the cost of the weapon. How do you do that? Additive manufacturing is almost certainly one of the keys for some of those weapons technologies, so scaling that up. But just in general, I think these are absolutely key. I will certainly highlight the department set up a biotechnology manufacturing institute. We thought that was an important first step.
Right.
Well, maybe second or third step in pushing biotechnology as a manufacturing capability with implications across the board, including logistics, new manufacturing processes, new materials. So I kind of agree with you. The manufacturing institutes were frankly an interesting experiment that I still have very high hopes for.
I do too. And I was fortunate enough to have a meeting a couple weeks ago with the director of CERTUP, Kim Spangler.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very interested in the biomanufacturing from the sense of, can I use biomanufacturing to get rid of this PFAS problem? Because I'm absorbing a lot of PFAS dollars to get
yeah.
you know, to get rid of it, remediate
right.
it. But could we help companies learn how to do it from a bio standard so we don't have a PFAS problem anymore?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't have to worry about this issue. But I think the department strategy has been, at least what you see from the public facing documents, is maybe this is a supply chain issue. Maybe because what we learned through COVID, if I can do things through bio, then I can have more control over what I'm doing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, the range of applications for bio are, I think, just fascinating. You know, being able to do construction materials that are bio,
mm-hmm.
Biotechnology. You know, instead of fixing runways the old-fashioned way, you sprinkle some microorganisms in, you sprinkle in some water, and it grows a new runway. Maybe in situ production of fuels enabled by biotechnology. So
energetics
and
pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So let's talk about the downside. Do you think see anything that you think is at most danger of being cut by Congress?
Well, like I said, when you propose a cut in in your budget up front, and if you like, if you're the Navy, right, and you said my priority is 6-4, but I'm gonna move all this money at 6-1 through 6-3, you know, they're putting themselves at risk, especially in this environment now where you've got a House of Representatives that is basically saying, look, we need to cut the federal spending down to FY22 levels. That's a across the board. It's $130 billion cut to the federal budget. You know, and you know, if I'm sitting there with the magic spreadsheet, be like, you know, those guys don't want the basic research. Guess what? We don't care either. You know, I think that that's real. Usually it's not. Usually, like, you know, as the building would say, like, if I cut it, they'll put it back. We're pretty familiar with this.
Yeah, especially basic research.
Especially basic research.
The expectation is, well, exactly as you say, we'll cut it, but they'll put it back for us.
And I think this time,
there's a risk.
There's a little bit of a risk, more so than ever. I'm not going to say that's. But also, looking at how OSD, I think, how they're trying to strategically put things out there. And I wonder if somebody's going to come back, especially in the authorization or the appropriation committee, to be like, well, how does that play into this conflict or that conflict?
Right, right.
You know, and somebody has to articulate, well, actually, I'm thinking about the conflict that you're not thinking about. And can they sell that?
So one of the things we've been doing a study here at ETI, as you know, looking at the S&T budgets going back about two decades. And one of the things that we have found is consistently Congress has always added money to the basic research portfolio. So it becomes part of the planning process. I request this amount because I know I'm going to get more. So you've already suggested that might not happen this year. But as a general
possibility.
Slim possibility. Slim possibility. Don't get riled up. Do not send cards and letters. But slim possibility. However, is that a dangerous thing to be budgeting with the expectation that, oh, I don't have to ask for this because I'm going to get it. It's going to be put in my budget for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I learned this lesson the hard way. Back in the Army, somebody had put in, back then what was called an earmark. Now we would know it was a congressional ad. And that was not put in. But yet there was still pressure from big Army back to the lab who said, that's a priority for the congressman. Go figure it out and fund it. And so I had to go back into the lab budget. And
came out of hide.
It came out of somebody else's pocket.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So there's, you know, and we all support the president's budget request when we're on that side of the world.
Yep.
But in this side of the world, we also support the Congress's.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to advise people this is not a long term strategy. If you want to be,
although it has been for a couple of decades now, but yeah.
You know, in specific programs, you know, I think the best way people can do things is to get equipment, get build your capacity to be competitive.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That makes sense. Well, I could talk to you about this subject and so much more for about the next hour or so, but I think we'll start losing our audience. So, Reed, let me have that as the last word. Build your capacity. Everyone, you've heard it. Apply for those DURIP funds. Also, those MURI funds are pretty good as well, but that comes after the DURIP funds. And a shout out to the S&T community and the DOD. I think when all is said and done, they do a phenomenal job. I've often said that one of the great strengths we have in our nation, especially national defense, is the strength of our S&T, our DOD S&T community. The part of it is the diversity of sources of funding. You know, if the Army doesn't want to fund me, I can go to the Navy. The Navy doesn't want to fund me, I go to the Air Force. If they don't want to fund me, I can go to DARPA. That gives you so many, you know,
a lot of doors. And if you do your footwork well, you'll find somebody.
And good ideas do percolate up to the top. So, Reed, thank you so much for joining us again. Thank you to our audience for listening, and have a good rest of your day.